living in an attic room in Ealing anymore. Giles had no power here. He's a vicious brute. It felt good to say it out loud. She had never done so before, had always felt that she had deserved what he meted out. David looked from one to the other, his thin face a picture of distress. I didn't know.
Of course you didn't, said Bay quickly. How could you?
Georgie felt a flare of annoyance that in this it was David that Bay thought to comfort. But it wasn't like that. Of course it wasn't. She lifted her hands to her temples, pressing hard with her fingers. It was a long time ago. David's face was white. If I had known, I didn't mean... I knew you never spoke of him, but... Bay was more attuned to David's nuances than she.
But what?
David looked unhappily at Georgie. He ducked his head over his coffee cup.
He said to send you his most sincere devotion, and that you would be hearing from him.
Chapter 21 Cold Spring, 1899, February 9th.
Mr. Giles Lacey!
The courtroom woke again. People twisted in their seats, whispered to one another, craned their necks for a sight of the latest sensation, the man who had provided the world with the titillating information that Annabel Van Dyvel, nay Lacey, was really Georgiana Smith, of uncertain parentage and dubious morals, the dubious morals being implied by the uncertain parentage. Mr. Lacey, in tailoring that proclaimed its own origin as not from here, took his time sauntering to the stand, allowing the crowd to look their fill. Even Janie's mother looked upon him with an auspicious eye, having determined that the enemy of one's enemy, if not one's friend, was one's ally. Janie wasn't quite so sure. There was something about him, about his obvious enjoyment of the attention, that put her on her guard. Turning with the rest to watch Giles Lacey, she caught Mr. Burke's eye in the back of the room and felt some of the tension in her stomach lighten. Which was ridiculous, she knew. If she had any sense, she would be as wary of Mr. Burke as she was of Mr. Lacey. But however absurd it was, she trusted that whatever his other motives, he would be dogged in his pursuit of the truth. There had been something in his face when he spoke of his work, something like the way her father had looked when he had been among his books. People could be careless about many things, her father had once said to her as he reverently turned the pages of a new acquisition, but not about the ones that mattered most to them.
Mr. Giles Peregrine Adolphus Lacey?
The coroner spoke the names with a remarkably straight face.
I am he.
Janie half expected to hear trumpets.
Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Mr. Lacey's eyes flickered sideways.
I swear.
The coroner got right down to the point.
You were cousin to Annabel Van Dyvel?
Yes,
said Mr. Lacey, drawing out the word. He flashed a smile at the press bench.
And no.
The coroner looked up, his lips pressing together.
That does not answer the question. It does, really.
Mr. Lacey rolled his shoulders one after the other, like an athlete preparing to enter the ring. The tightly tailored material of his suit moved with him, causing, as the papers would no doubt report later, no little fluttering among the female members of the audience. Personally, Janie wasn't feeling the least bit fluttery, but she could envision the newsprint already. Some of the reporters might even believe it.
Annabel Lacey was my cousin, and Mrs. Bayard Van Dyvel was my cousin, across the bar sinister, as it were. But Annabel Van Dyvel, there was no such woman.
That, said the coroner, is a very serious allegation.
It is a matter I take very seriously indeed,
said Mr. Lacey gravely, but there was a light in his eyes that reminded Janie of a rider taking a difficult fence.
serious, perhaps, but exhilarated, pitting himself against the elements.
"My cousin Annabel was very dear to me. We were," he added confidingly, "to be married."
An excited murmur ran through the courtroom.
"I still have the license," said Mr. Lacey, turning to the coroner.
He produced it from his pocket, a crumpled piece of paper on which the ink had run from rough treatment.
"I have kept it with me all these years, as a keepsake, and in hope that against all odds my Annabel might be returned to me."
The coroner took the piece of paper with the tips of his fingers, handing it to the bailiff.
"May the record reflect that the witness has produced a marriage license for one Giles Lacey and one Annabel Lacey, dated the 5th of May, 1891.
"It is, of course," said Mr. Lacey, "more traditional to cry the banns, but neither Annabel nor I wanted to wait to, join our lives together. You understand, I'm sure, what it is to be young and in love."
Half the men in the audience were smirking along with Mr. Lacey. Mr. Burke caught Janie's eye and grimaced. "People do stupid things at 16. Janie looked away, focusing very closely on the coroner as he handed another piece of paper to the bailiff.
"Here," said the coroner, sounding very weary, "is a picture of Mrs. Bayard Van Dyvel, hereafter to be referred to as Exhibit 16. Mr. Lacey, can you identify the woman in this picture?"
He had, Janie was sure, read the papers, but the form of the law needed to be followed. Janie felt very sorry for the coroner. Mr. Lacey held the picture out in one hand, scrutinizing it with exaggerated effort. At length, he set it down.
"I regret to say that I can. This is Georgiana Smith, my cousin's natural daughter."
"Thank you, Mr. Lacey. You may—"
"My cousin never acknowledged her, of course. He called her his ward. But everyone knew, and it ate away at Georgie. That's what everyone called her. Georgie."
The disdain in Mr. Lacey's voice was palpable.
"Yes, Mr. Lacey, thank—"
Mr. Lacey stampeded on.
"Whatever Annabel had, Georgie wanted. She couldn't bear that Annabel was Miss Lacey of Lacey Abbey, and she was lower than a foundling. She used to deck herself in Annabel's cast-offs and play at being a lady. It was my cousin's fault, of course, for raising her with Annabel. He ought to have known better. It gave the girl ideas above her station."
Next to her, Janie's mother was regarding Mr. Lacey with approval. Her mother had strong ideas about people with ideas above their station. Anne shifted uncomfortably in her seat, the rich purple grosgrain of her skirt in odd contrast to the scarred wood of the bench.
"Georgie was sick with jealousy of Annabel. She even had a mad idea that Annabel's brother was really her brother, her twin, torn away from her at birth because my cousin needed a male heir to inherit the abbey."
Mr. Lacey laughed, but the sound was hollow.
"If that isn't insane, I ask you, what is?"
"Thank you, Mr. Lacey."
The coroner half rose from his seat.
"You have been very helpful. That's why, when Annabel disappeared, I knew immediately what must have happened. I didn't want to believe it. Who would? No one wants to think that someone they know is capable of—"
Mr. Lacey's voice dropped thrillingly.
"The ultimate sin."
The coroner sat back down in his chair, looking in serious need of a headache powder.
"What are you implying, Mr. Lacey?"
"I'm not implying it, I'm saying it."
For a moment there was almost a dignity about Mr. Lacey, but then he spoiled it by saying incredulously,
"Can you believe she had the gall to come to me and tell me that now that Annabel was gone we could be together, as if I would ever lower myself to marry the likes of her?"
Janie's gloved hands were cold. She pressed them together in her lap, her breath tight in her chest. Of everything Mr. Lacey had said, this had the ring of truth. The indignation, the arrogance, everything else had sounded like a sham, but this, in all its ugliness, its naked pride, sounded more like memory than fabrication. Mr. Lacey's voice dropped to a throbbing baritone. I have spent the past 7 years trying to bring Georgiana Smith to justice for the murder of my cousin Annabel.
The courtroom exploded into excited chatter, but Mr. Lacey managed to raise his voice just enough to get one valedictory shot into the fray.
When I heard what had happened here, I knew. She's killed before. Why wouldn't she kill again?
The bailiff had to call for order several times before the noise in the courtroom abated, and even then the room kept bursting into excited chatter. One woman had fainted, managing to aim herself clear across a full row of people, upsetting one man's flask, which saturated the room with the scent of strong alcohol. The press bench were in an uproar, divided between staying to see what else Mr. Lacey might have to say and rushing off to be first to telephone the scoop back to their respective news organs. If impostors made good news, mad, murderous impostors were even better. Mr. Lacey leaned back against the wooden back of the stand, well pleased with the sensation he had created. The coroner pounded the table with his gavel to no avail, looking as if he rather wished it were Giles's head.
"Thank you, Mr. Lacey," he said when he was able to make himself heard. "You may step down." "But the court is adjourned sine die. We will reconvene in the morning."
There was grumbling, but the sky was already turning the early dark of winter. The courtroom, even with the press of people, was colder than comfortable, which, Janie noticed, hadn't prevented a light sheen of sweat from appearing on the coroner's forehead. She didn't blame him. It wouldn't take much for the excitement in the room to turn ugly.
"It's too fantastical," Janie said to Anne as the room behind them heaved with people gathering possessions and jostling toward the doors. "Lost heirs and false twins and impersonations?"
"The press appears to be enjoying it," said Anne.
As they both looked to the press bench, Mr. Burke tipped his hat at Janie, then turned to file out with the rest. Anne adjusted her fur-lined cuffs, her eyes on Burke's retreating back.
"Should you be fraternizing with the press, Janie?"
"It's not what you think," said Janie, and felt her cheeks pink at the look Anne gave her. Anne, of all people.
"We needed someone who would tell us frankly what was being said. I have an arrangement with Mr. Burke, a business arrangement."
A network of lines fanned from Anne's nose to her lips.
"Don't be naive, Janie. They're all out for what they can get. You should look how you go."
Something about Anne's dismissive tone tweaked Janie's temper.
"They meaning journalists, or they meaning men?"
"Both."
Anne settled her furs closer about her neck.
"You shouldn't play at games you don't understand. If you knew the world as I do, or Mr. Burke as you do," retorted Janie, nettled.
She might not have the benefit of a continental tour and philandering husband, but she had eyes and ears. She was sick of everyone treating her like an invalid.
"Bay would want me to look out for you," said Anne shortly. "I'm only telling you this for your own good. James Burke is using you."
"As you did him?"
"He looked well in breeches," Anne had told her. "Wouldn't you have run away, too?"
"Did you never stop to think that you might have wronged him? You got a scolding from Mother. Burke was thrown onto the streets."
"Must you be so dramatic about it? I never meant him harm. It wasn't my fault Aunt Alva overreacted."
Anne twitched at her furs.
"I should think you would have more pride than to cultivate my cast-offs."
Janie looked at her cousin, really looked at her, at the fine lines of her face, prematurely aged with discontent, the flamboyant stuff of her gown, the mourning bands on her sleeves that were wider than custom required. And she found, for the first time, that Anne had no power to daunt her.
"I never took your cast-offs. You married mine."
And as Anne's face changed from shock to anger, Janie added genuinely,
"I only wish it had brought you more joy."
It took Anne several tries to find her tongue.
Teddy laughed about you!
And now Teddy was laughing about Anne, somewhere on a yacht in the south of France, with his candidate for second wife already in residence. Janey moved so that they stood on the very edge of the steps, away from the madding crowd.
Why did you say I was first to find Bay?
Anne looked away, her face half buried in her luxuriant fox stole.
Weren't you?
Once Janey might have mumbled something conciliatory and agreed that Anne must be right. But not now. Not anymore.
No, you were.
Forgive me if I was too busy grieving to be making timetables.
Anne fumbled for the gold case at her waist.
I need a cigarette. Don't even think of it.
Janey's mother took Anne by the arm, marching her down the stairs as though she were a child of 10 caught experimenting with her aunt's powder.
I won't have you making a display for these people.
Oh, for the love of—
Anne shrugged away from her aunt.
Don't you see that it's too late?
Get in the carriage,
was all Janey's mother said, but an unspoken message seemed to pass between them. With one dark look over her shoulder, Anne obeyed, climbing into the closed carriage Mr. Tilden had arranged to convey them from Carmel to the house in Cold Spring. Janey's mother followed, with the dignity of an offended dowager. Mr. Tilden handed Janey into the carriage last. He looked as though he wanted to apologize for it, but then he always looked as though he wanted to apologize.
That, said Mrs. Van Dyvel, as Mr. Tilden had settled himself next to Janey on the rear-facing seat, went as well as one might expect. Mr. Lacey was quite effective.
Effective?
Anne repeated flatly, looking at her aunt with loathing. Turning to Mr. Tilden, she demanded,
How much more of this?
That, said Mr. Tilden, choosing his words carefully, depends upon how many witnesses the coroner chooses to call. Should he feel that this matter can be resolved, he will, of course—
Resolved?
Anne put her hands to her face. It took Janey a moment to realize that she was laughing. Wild, uncontrollable laughter.
Just wrap it up in a tidy little package, and never mind that Bay is— Oh, God.
Janey's mother's hands were tight in her lap.
Control yourself.
Why? What else can happen? Will the word get out that your niece was seen having an unsightly fit of emotion? We can't allow that to occur.
You sound just like your mother.
Mrs. Van Dyvel's voice was so low, Janey almost couldn't make out the words.
And thank goodness for that,
said Anne, swiping her eyes with one hand in a way that revealed beyond doubt that the color of her lashes was due to art rather than nature.
Your mother was a disgrace.
And why was that? Because she wouldn't dance to your tune? Because she married my father?
The carriage jolted over a rut.
Goodness, said Mr. Tilden brightly. The roads are difficult at this time of year.
Your father, said Mrs. Van Dyvel, was unbalanced.
Her voice was controlled, but her hands were in fists in her lap, and there was a tension in the air that made the cold coach feel several degrees colder.
Only because you drove him to it, egging on his competitors, buying up his mortgages.
The venom in Anne's voice would have stripped the paint off the exterior.
Why did you hate them so much? Was it because they actually enjoyed themselves, or because they had no use for you?
A loud crack rent the air. It was all over in a moment. Anne crouched in the corner of the seat, cradling her cheek with one hand, Janey's mother sitting very upright, staring straight ahead.
I would advise, said Mrs. Van Dyvel in a tight voice, that you take a tray in your room tonight.
Slowly, Anne lowered her gloved hand. There was a bold red mark on her cheek, like a brand.
And there you have it, she said to Mr. Tilden. My aunt's favorite way of resolving the matter. Make it disappear.
Mr. Tilden rubbed his gloved hands together.
"Is it just my imagination, or has it grown colder? They say that this may be the coldest February on record."
When no one took up his lead, he tried another tack.
"I am looking forward to a hot supper. There is nothing like a warm meal on a cold day, as that great man Samuel Johnson once said."
Mrs. Van Dyvel just looked at him.
"I think," she said, "we should all take trays in our rooms."
The rest of the ride to Illyria was conducted in silence.
Chapter 22. Cold Spring, 1899. January 5th.
"I had a letter from my aunt today."
Georgie smelled Anne's cigarette before she saw her, heard the thin exhalation of breath that followed her pronouncement.
"Did you?"
Georgie asked absently, moving so that she could catch the light from the narrow window panes, strategically broken to emulate the originals at Lacey Abbey. She didn't have time for Anne's vapors today. Tomorrow the house would be overrun with guests, starting with a formal dinner at 8, followed by the ball at 10. Only the family would be staying in the house, but that still meant that rooms needed to be prepared for Mrs. Van Dyvel and Janie, stocked with new stationery, furnished with flowers, and really just furnished. The cabinet makers had been more than accommodating, but only a fraction of the bedrooms were fully furnished, it having seemed wiser to concentrate on the public rooms in the wake of the coming ball.
"Aunt Alva's told me I meant to talk sense into you."
"Lovely."
Georgie stifled a yawn as she turned away from the window, heading for the blue bedroom. The children had been excited about the idea of the new house until the time had come to move. Bast had taken it well enough, but Viola had kicked and screamed, demanding to be allowed to go back, which, naturally enough, had set Bast off as well. Georgie had been up until the wee hours soothing first one, then the other, cradling them and rocking them, and praying they would eventually grow tired enough to sleep. If she'd gone to bay, he would have come. He had done his share of sitting up with Bast when he had a cough, or checking under Vi's bed for goblins. But bay hadn't been in his room. And Georgie, while she could be forbearing about her husband's infidelity in theory, found herself reluctant to see it in practice. Which was a fancy way of saying that the idea of bay in bed with someone else made her stomach churn. After almost 2 years, one would have thought she would have been used to it. But she wasn't. And she wasn't sure she would ever be used to it. Anne drifted along after Georgie, impervious to her lack of encouragement.
"I am to exhort you to return to town, now that the house is finished."
Anne followed up that last with a sidelong look that spoke far more than her words.
"Whatever did you say to my dear aunt? She jabbed her pen so hard it nearly left holes in the paper. I could practically hear her fulminating."
Georgie added another note to her list. Fresh writing paper in all the rooms, embossed with a stylized picture of Illyria.
"We mostly spoke of you."
"Touché, my dear, touché. Was it one of Auntie's touching homilies on the sanctity of marriage? Tell that to Teddy, or Ellen Morris."
Anne trailed after Georgie into the blue room.
"To be fair, if it hadn't been Ellen, it would have been one of the chambermaids, or an Italian contessa, or the girl who sells flowers in the street. Teddy wasn't precisely discriminating with his favors."
"So you've said,"
several times since her arrival, "the iniquities of Teddy, an operetta in three parts." Georgie rubbed her aching temples with the hand holding her pencil, feeling just a bit lightheaded from lack of sleep. Plumping herself down on a blue silk divan, Anne slid another Turkish cigarette out of its gold case and tapped it against her palm.
"Janie doesn't know what a favor I did her."
Georgie checked the writing desk, making sure there was enough ink in the inkwell. Blue, to go with the wallpaper and bed hangings.
"I rather doubt she saw it that way." "She ought."
Anne struck a match, holding it to the tip of the narrow cylinder. She inhaled deeply.
"Divorce isn't for the faint of heart. Of course, it's not what it was. You can get away with it now without having to don sackcloth and go around doing good works to atone. After all, if Mrs. Vanderbilt can rid herself of her philandering boor of a husband, surely there's hope for the rest of us."
Georgie made a note to herself to see that flowers were put in the rooms. Pansies and sweet peas for Janie, orchids for Mrs. Vandyval. She had no idea whether Mrs. Vandyval liked orchids, but they were expensive, and as such her mother-in-law would see them as her due.
"The Sticklers don't receive Mrs. Vanderbilt since her divorce, do they?"
Anne smiled crookedly.
"That's the best part. No more dull debutante dances, no more patriarch's ball. I can be as fast as I like and still be invited to the more entertaining sorts of parties."
Despite herself, Georgie lowered her list and looked at her cousin by marriage.
"What will you do once it's done?"
"Marry someone else, of course. What else?"
Anne looked at her sideways.
"I'd have Bay, but he's already taken."
So much for sympathy. Georgie took up her notebook again.
"You might travel. And have people say I'm running away. Let Teddy eat food soaked in oil."
Anne arranged herself in a proprietary way on the divan.
"Here I stay."
"Please, no," thought Georgie. 2 weeks of Anne had been more than enough to last her a lifetime. The only consolation was that Mrs. Vandyval had grudgingly condescended to take Anne back to town once the ball was done. Only one day more. One day more. Georgie realized she had been looking at the ball as one might the distant towers of a town in the desert, assuming, without quite thinking it through, that once the ball was done, everything would be different. Once the ball was done, the house would be officially finished. Once the ball was done, they would have no more need for an architect. Once the ball was done, Mrs. Vandyval would stop pestering them about neglecting their duty to society. Once the ball was done, they could settle into their life as a family again. Once the ball was done. But as the ball drew closer, Georgie was beginning to suspect that the towers might be a mirage, that the weary journey wasn't ended at all, that beyond the sands were only more sands, trekking endlessly on. She wished the house had never been begun, that Bay had never had the idea of making a doll's house of Lacey Abbey for Viola, that Anne had never introduced David, that they were still living in the comfortable old house Bay's great-great-grandparents had built. This new house, this Lacey Abbey in exile, felt more like a stage set than a home. Everything was too new, too shiny, too rich. It didn't feel like coming home. It felt like a judgment for all the times she had envied Annabel, the times she had imagined herself mistress of Lacey Abbey, queen of all she surveyed. This wasn't a house, but a penance. Georgie fantasized for a moment about the whole thing burning down, going up in a blaze of flame. Flame purified, they said. She could exorcise it all, send the past and the present winging into the sky in one great bonfire, all purified and made new. But then David would only have to stay on to build another one, wouldn't he?
"Have the abbey," Annabel had said. "I don't want it."
And she had half hated Annabel for that. No, not half hated, had truly hated Annabel for that, for her casual rejection of all Georgie's desirings. It had seemed so unfair that Annabel should have everything she, Georgie, wanted, and not even take joy in it. Love and hate mingled all together.
"My dear," said Anne, "are you quite all right? You look as though someone's been dancing on your grave."
"And wouldn't you like that?" Georgie almost said, but controlled herself.
"If you're at loose ends," she suggested, "you might find Mrs. Garrett for me. I want to make sure she puts the right flowers in the right room."
"I live to serve."
But Anne made no move to take herself off to the housekeeper's quarters, a spacious apartment utterly unlike the inconvenient dark rooms Georgie remembered from the Lacey Abbey of her childhood.
Anne propped herself on one elbow and looked at Georgie through a plume of cigarette smoke.
"What would you do if you weren't married to Bay?"
"Go on the stage," said Georgie, only half paying attention.
In the old house she could hear the children from rooms away, but here the walls were too solid. The silence bothered her.
"Wouldn't that be an upset for Aunt Alva? But really, there must be something, or someone, you dream about."
If there were, she wouldn't tell Anne.
"I'm quite happy here." "I forgot. You have your house."
Anne made it sound like something sordid, blood money.
"Is it worth it?" "Was yours,"
retorted Georgie, and then regretted it. It would be one thing if sinking to Anne's level silenced her, but it only encouraged her to go on, and on. Anne took it as an excuse to follow Georgie from the blue room, saying confidingly, "We really are in the same boat, aren't we? Both of us rich in possessions, abandoned by our husbands."
"I wouldn't say abandoned. The last time I saw Bay, he was dealing with the vintner."
Who had delivered the wrong cases of champagne. Georgie paused on the landing, where David had from somewhere unearthed genuine Jacobean oak, blackened with age. It was an odd feeling, being both in the present and the past.
"Bay does periodically like to wander off with a book of poetry, but he generally comes back in time for tea."
That stymied Anne for a few moments. She followed Georgie in silence down the stairs before saying conversationally,
"I'm surprised you haven't divorced Bay."
Georgie had had enough of cat and mouse. Looking at Anne, she said distinctly,
"Why would I?"
"My dear." Anne's voice was thick with pity, but that was as far as she dared go.
"Mrs. Van Dyvel?"
It was one of the gardener's boys. Mrs. Garrett would have his head if she found him in the house trekking mud under her floors.
"Gentleman wants you down by the river."
Georgie could have hugged him.
"Pardon me, Anne. David has some questions about the decorations for the folly."
Ha! Let Anne see what a happy family they were, even if they weren't.
"If you want to be useful," she added, handing Anne her notebook, "you can take this to Mrs. Garrett. We need orchids in the red room, sweet peas in the blue room, and Garrett needs to have someone do something about the chimney in the small parlor. It's smoking again."
It was almost worth it to be able to leave Anne behind, marooned in the grandeur of the hall. Georgie cut through the door beneath the minstrel's gallery, through the passage that cut between the billiard room and the music room. Just as she used to do when she was a child, when she and Annabel and George had known the back passages of Lacey Abbey as a pianist knew his notes, or a blacksmith his tools. She could remember, even now, the feel of George's hand in hers, and the emptiness later on. George and Georgiana, Georgiana and George. Had it suited her father to name his bastard children after himself? Or had it been her mother who had done so, in a bid to win her lover's allegiance? A compliment to his virility, if not his morals. Georgie suspected the latter, but she would never know for certain. Her mother had died of childbed fever, a common enough occurrence, and particularly in India. Georgie had no memories of her, no pictures, only the name her mother had given her, Georgiana. Nor had her father ever spoken to her of her mother. The polite fiction had been maintained, at all times, in private as well as in public, that Colonel Lacey was merely her benefactor, not her father, that George was Annabel's brother, not Georgie's. And then George had died, and it had all been for nothing, all her father's subterfuge, the lies, the pretense. She could remember still those long nights, Annabel creeping into her bed in the nursery, lying with their arms around each other, needing the solidity of each other, holding on to each other as though trying to ward off fate. It felt, at times, as though Georgie had exchanged one twin for another, as though with George gone, Annabel had fallen into his place, the other half of her, neither complete without the other. Annabel might put on airs at times, they might squabble as sisters did,
But in the end, there was always that, the feel of their arms around each other in the dead of night, keeping each other safe. She and Annabelle, all in all to each other, two halves of the same coin. Georgie slipped out a side door, blinking in the January glare, so much brighter and harsher than the light at home. The past and the present danced around each other in an intricate pas de deux, spinning in and out. The house, so familiar and so strange, sprawled across the rise, the land sloping gently down behind to the river, and the ruins of the old abbey that stood like a bulwark against time on the verge of the banks. She could see, through the bare branches of the trees, the spiky emptiness of rose bushes without their bloom, the shadow of a man. Not the form, just a shadow. They used to meet there, Annabelle and her lover. But it wasn't Annabelle's lover, and these weren't the ruins. Georgie recalled herself with a shake of her head. That was the folly. Their own folly, not the folly of monks centuries past. And that wasn't Annabelle's lover lurking beneath the bare ruined choirs where nothing yet sang. It was David, with yet another trifling question in which she had to pretend an interest when she had no interest at all. Poor David. He made a point of deferring to her in all his decisions, ostensibly because she was the Lacey of Lacey Abbey, and the woman for whom this edifice had been constructed. But really, Georgie knew, because he felt guilty. She was tired of assuaging his guilt. Really, she was just tired. "Let their nurse sit up with them," Bay would tell her. "That's what we pay her for." And perhaps she should. But she wouldn't. They were hers, Vi and Bast, hers as no one else was or ever would be, and she loved them with a love that sometimes terrified her. She had finally fallen asleep somewhere past dawn in the rocking chair in the nursery, with Vi slumped bonelessly on top of her and Sebastian curled on the rug at her feet. She had woken a scant hour later to find that the fire had all but burned out, her toes were numb, and she'd lost all feeling in her arm and thigh. She had carried Viola and Sebastian to their beds, one by one, tucking them under their covers and leaving instructions with their nurse not to wake them for breakfast. Let them sleep in the warmth of their blankets while they could. Maybe she should ignore David, ignore the preparations and just crawl into bed. It would be a decadent thing, going to bed in the middle of the day.
"When I'm grown up, I'm going to sleep as long as I like."
A voice from the past. Annabelle, with that glint in her eye. Annabelle, who had been so sure the world would be hers. Annabelle Lacey, of Lacey Abbey. For a moment, Georgie thought she could see her by the river, her long hair pulled back at the sides and left to fall free, putting out a leg to jump onto that dilapidated old raft they used to pole up and down the river.
"One last go? They won't miss us for hours yet."
And then the sun winked behind the clouds, and Annabelle was gone, and Georgie was alone, wishing she had had the sense to wear a fur-lined cloak rather than relying on a wool dress and woolly shawl.
"Hello?"
David was probably somewhere in the depths of the folly, calculating something or other. That he was very good at what he did, Georgie knew. She just didn't feel particularly constrained to pay any attention to it.
"David?"
It was dark inside the folly, dark and cold. David had reproduced it perfectly, the fallen arches of the cloisters, the roofless rectangle of the refectory.
"David!"
Georgie called again, impatiently now because it was cold and she was tired and enough was enough. She'd never liked the ruins. They had been Annabelle's place, not hers.
"Were you expecting your lover?"
A man stepped through the hollow door of the refectory, down a hollowed step. He had abandoned his caped greatcoat for a fitted model that was more in the mode, with black velvet insets in the collar. His tall hat cast a shadow over his face, but there was no mistaking him.
"Hello, Annabelle," said Giles.
Georgie took a deep breath of the cold January air.
"Hello, Giles. It's been a long time,"
7 years, said Giles, and waited. Once the sight of Giles would have had her cold with fear. But right now, Georgie just felt numb. Numb and tired.
What do you want, Giles?
His eyes traveled over her with deliberate insolence.
Is that any way to greet your long-lost cousin, Annabelle? Can we dispense with the theatrics?
400 people would be arriving in just over 24 hours, including half a dozen houseguests.
I won't ask how you found me. David told me he'd written you about the house.
You knew? The surprise on his face was almost comical.
Of course, Georgie lied. Really, Giles, you said it yourself. It's been 7 years. Time enough to let sleeping dogs lie.
Balked, Giles scowled at her.
You always did land on your feet, didn't you?
Not always. That horrible first month in London, a breath away from jumping into the river. She'd thought of it more than once. But it had been stubbornness that had helped her survive. Stubbornness and a determination not to let Giles win. Was it her imagination, or did he seem smaller? It might just be that she was accustomed now to tall men. Or it could be that this was her house and her land. And her ruins, for that matter.
Is this a social call? Come to the house and I'll make you known to my husband.
She turned to go, gathering the folds of her shawl around her. But Giles closed the gap with 2 quick strides, grabbing her arm and yanking her around to face him, so hard that she stumbled and almost fell.
And risk my telling him the truth?
Giles's face was so close that she could smell the spirits on his breath as he snarled,
"Where is she, Georgie? What did you do with Annabelle?"
"Where you won't find her,"
Georgie retorted, and stepped hard on his foot.
"Damn you, George!"
It was hard to look threatening while hopping on one foot. Georgie watched him, hopping and swearing, and wondered how she had ever found him handsome, had ever fancied herself in love with him.
"Keep your hands to yourself," she said coolly, "or I'll call the constables and have you locked up for assault and trespass." "That's rich from a murderess."
Giles looked up from his half-crouch, his face ugly with hatred and fear.
"Was it the river? Did you throw her in the river, or was it someplace else?"
After all this time, Georgie put her hands to her temples. She could feel the seams in the leather against her skin.
"I never hurt Annabelle. I tried to tell you, Giles."
That afternoon, running to Giles, telling him that Annabelle was missing, gone. The horrifying rage on Giles's face. Rage and, most crushing, fear.
"Where is she? What did you do to her?"
And then the press of the splintered wood wall against her back, Giles's face over hers, dark with anger, his knee pressing between her skirts.
"Did you really think I would marry you?"
Giles rose from his crouch. He limped forward, favoring his left foot, but stopped at a glare from Georgie.
"Then where is she?"
"New South Wales," said Georgie wearily. "New South what?"
Giles's mouth gaped. It made him look a few pence short of a pound.
"New South Wales," repeated Georgie.
It couldn't hurt to tell him now, could it? She had kept her part of the bargain. For a moment, Georgie found herself missing Annabelle fiercely. Missing her and also wanting to slap her.
"It's in Australia. They farm sheep there." "But..."
Giles cleared his throat a few times.
"Her shoe!"
"And her scarf,"
Georgie reminded him.
"That was Annabelle's doing."
Giles just stared at her, uncomprehending. Georgie sighed.
"She ran from you, Giles," she said, speaking slowly and clearly in words he could understand. "She ran away because she didn't want to marry you."
It felt good saying it. It was as though she could breathe, really breathe, for the first time in 7 years.
Giles shook his head in mute denial.
She was going to marry me.
Georgie pressed her eyes shut. No, you were going to marry her. There's a difference.
No.
Giles's brows drew together.
No.
Georgie tucked her hands beneath the edges of her shawl, feeling the January chill seeping into her bones. Annabel knew that if she eloped, you would come after her, so she found another way. With all the blithe insouciance of 17, it had seemed like such a good idea at the time. It had never occurred to either of them that their plans might go awry. Annabel would have Adam, and Georgie would have Giles and the Abbey. All fair and square. Except it never quite worked that way, did it? Thought Georgie wearily. Only for the Annabels of the world, the gold-touched children on whom the sun always shone. Giles bristled.
Eloped? What are you on about? Who would it have been? There was no one.
He sputtered to a stop, apprehension written across his face as Georgie stood there looking at him, waiting for him to finish.
Wasn't there?
She said. Giles cast about feverishly for rivals.
No. Who else was there? Old Enderby up at the manor, but he was 50 if he was a day. Hawkswood in the militia was toothsome enough, but he was on the lookout for an heiress. Everyone knew that. No.
Giles looked at Georgie with ugly satisfaction on his face.
There was no one who could offer her what I could. Name, position, me.
Perhaps not, Georgie said. Nevertheless, Annabel was in love with Adam Ferrers.
The farmer?
The disbelief on Giles's face was almost funny. Georgie drew in a deep breath through her nose, remembering the shadows in the ruins, Annabel and Adam trysting in the twilight. She had tasked Annabel with it, warning her that she was risking her reputation. But Annabel only laughed and said she didn't care for her reputation. She only cared for Adam. And someday, Georgie might understand.
She'd been meeting him in secret for months, said Georgie flatly. It wasn't anything to do with you, Giles. It was never anything to do with you. You're lying, he said hoarsely. She wouldn't have done that. She was going to come around. Just a little time.
Enough was enough. She had children to care for, and 5 jugglers and 6 jongleurs who needed to be fed and given their instructions. Georgie turned to go.
She didn't want to marry you, Giles.
Giles followed after her, out into the pitiless January sunlight.
You're just saying that. You did it because you wanted me, didn't you? You wanted me and the Abbey.
He stopped stubbornly on an artistically cracked flagstone.
She wouldn't just leave her inheritance like that. She wouldn't leave the Abbey.
Wouldn't she? Georgie looked back at him.
You never did know Annabel at all, did you? Annabel never cared for money or position.
And it was true. Having always had it, Annabel had never considered the lack of it. Of course, that was only so long as she wasn't challenged. When challenged, Annabel could lord it with the best of them, particularly over Georgie. It was time to end this once and for all.
She thought you were a nuisance, Giles. She said your endless stories about the horse guards were enough to send anyone howling into the wilderness.
Georgie couldn't resist adding,
when it came down to it, she preferred the company of sheep.
Giles squinted at her in the sunlight.
You vicious slut!
Georgie felt her back stiffen. She gathered her skirts and walked determinedly up the path to the house.
If you don't like the truth, don't come looking for it.
She could hear Giles's voice, low with anger.
Do you want to talk about the truth, Annabel? Goodbye, Giles.
Georgie didn't turn.
One foot after the other. Don't look back.
He was like a monster under the bed. He couldn't hurt her unless she let him.
Does your husband know about you? Does he know who you are?
Just keep walking. That was what she needed to do. Never let him know he had struck a nerve. Georgie turned, saying patiently, Go home, Giles. There's nothing for you here.
Giles remained rooted where he was, staring after her.
You made a fool of me.
Not love, then, but pride.
You and Annabelle.
And you took your revenge.
Georgie stopped herself before saying it. She wouldn't give him that power over her. Not again. Not ever.
Go find Annabelle and take it up with her, said Georgie. I'm sure you'll have a lovely time in New South Wales. So many friendly sheep.
What if I were to attend your ball? Would you dance with me?
Giles made to follow her, but stopped with a wince as he landed on the foot she had stomped on. But that didn't stop him from one last valedictory shot. The words carried on the wind behind her.
This isn't over, Annabelle.
Chapter 23 Cold Spring, 1899 February 10th
Annabelle found, exclaimed the headline on the New York Journal, but only halfway down the page. The weather had pushed missing murderesses down the page, beneath reports of cattle freezing in the fields, chunks of ice in the port of New Orleans, and snow in parts of the South that were entirely unused to the phenomenon and not best pleased. In New York, the temperatures had ducked well below zero and seemed set to stay that way, a fact that appeared to have had some effect on the crowd around the courtroom, which seemed smaller than yesterday's by a large margin. Or perhaps after yesterday's dramatic testimony, they thought they had learned all they needed to know? Once one got past the frozen cattle, the papers had vied to supply sightings of Annabelle Van Dyvel, a.k.a. Georgiana Smith, a.k.a. goodness only knew. She'd been seen boarding the Staten Island Ferry, on a train to Des Moines, and in a bathhouse in Yorkville. The World had offered a $500 reward for reliable information as to her whereabouts. The Journal had upped it to $750 and a large ham haunch. All of the papers were agreed on one point. Annabelle Van Dyvel was an impostor and a murderess who had killed her husband to escape discovery. It was only on the details that they varied. Not one, Janie had noticed, made any mention of Georgina Evans, actress. By now the courtroom had a strange feeling of familiarity to it, as if she had spent her life sitting on this same bench in this same courtroom day after day. Janie remembered the long train trips to Saratoga Springs having the same quality in her youth, feeling as though they had been traveling and would go on traveling forever, eating in the same dining car, among the same passengers. That, of course, was before her mother had discovered the joys of private rail cars. As they passed the press bench, Janie heard one of the reporters say to another,
"Sure to be a verdict today."
And the other replied,
"Better hope. I'd like to be home before hell freezes over."
"It already has,"
said the first one, scooting a little closer to the pot-bellied stove, which was doing an entirely inadequate job of heating the room. Everyone left their coats on, the high collars and hats and mufflers giving the assemblage a slightly sinister air. Next to Janie, Anne's head emerged out of a pile of stone martens, each biting the other's tail, the eyes replaced with jet beads. She looked, thought Janie, like a goddess of the hunt, the sort who changed men into deer and then shot them. She didn't see Mr. Burke in the room. As the coroner took his place and consulted his notes, Janie tried to clear her head. She had discovered Bay, at least in Anne's version of the story. Her reprieve could last only so long. The coroner lifted his head, but it wasn't Janie's name that he called.
"Mr. Giles Lacey?"
The crowd stirred, heads emerging from mufflers, people sitting straighter on their benches. Mr. Lacey strutted up to the podium like a society beauty honoring the masses, looking neither to left nor right, acknowledging no one, but preening at the attention all the same. He was news, and he knew it. He flipped his tails as he took his seat, waiting with an air of exaggerated patience for the coroner to ask the first question.
The coroner took his time, adjusting his spectacles, reviewing his notes, smoothing his mustache. Giles shifted impatiently, propping one ankle against the opposite thigh.
"Yesterday," said the coroner, "you alleged that the woman known as Annabel Van Dyvel was, in truth, one Georgiana Smith. Is that correct?"
"My good man," drawled Mr. Lacey, "I wouldn't have said it if it weren't." A titter ran through certain portions of the courtroom. The coroner didn't look at them. Instead, he focused his spectacles on Mr. Lacey, saying mildly,
"Do you have any proof of this, Mr. Lacey?"
"I knew them both," said Mr. Lacey impatiently. "Isn't that proof enough?"
"A record of birth, perhaps," suggested the coroner.
Mr. Lacey made a dismissive gesture.
"The lot of them, my cousin and her brother and Georgie, were all born in India. Would you like me to try to find their old Aya?"
"What about in England?"
the coroner asked, and Janie had to admire his doggedness.
"There was an old nurse, but she must be 90 if she's a day, if she's still with us. But there's no need, I tell you. Georgiana Smith was Annabel's half-sister. They looked alike if you didn't see them next to each other. Anyone would tell you the same."
"Do you have any affidavits from these anyones?"
"Affidavits?" Mr. Lacey sputtered. "Why would I have such a thing?"
The coroner persevered.
"Could you provide such affidavits if given the time to do so?"
Mr. Lacey frowned at him, no longer amused.
"Most of my cousin's staff left after his death. The girls weren't out yet. They might have played with some of the tenant farmer's children in their youth."
"In other words, no."
The coroner looked up from his notes, saying with awful clarity, "Mr. Lacey, can you bring any evidence that the woman known as Annabel Van Dyvel was, in fact, Georgiana Smith?"
"Don't you think I would know my own cousin?"
Mr. Lacey's voice echoed through the courtroom, rich with frustration.
"I tell you, I saw her. It wasn't Annabel. It was Georgie."
"You saw her?"
A current of interest went through the room. The journalists picked up their discarded notebooks. Mr. Lacey blinked for a moment, looking utterly unnerved.
"I mean, I saw a picture of her. Mrs. Van Dyvel showed me a picture."
Gaining confidence, he added,
"It wasn't Annabel."
"You determined that from a picture," said the coroner.
He didn't sound convinced, and neither was Janie. Mr. Lacey half rose in his seat.
"Don't you understand? She's a murderess. She killed Annabel, and she killed her husband, and she'll probably kill someone else if she isn't brought to justice."
His words didn't have nearly the effect they had had the day before.
"That," said the coroner placidly, "is a very serious allegation. Do you have any proof, Mr. Lacey?"
Mr. Lacey subsided sulkily into his seat.
"Annabel's body was never found, just her shoe. It's probably what gave Georgie the idea. She knew how to set the scene because she knew what it looked like when someone gets pushed into a river."
"What were the results of the inquest into Miss Lacey's disappearance, Mr. Lacey?"
Mr. Lacey mumbled something.
"A bit louder, Mr. Lacey."
"They wouldn't declare her dead," muttered Mr. Lacey.
"Let me make sure I have this correct," said the coroner. "You have no proof that there was such a person as Georgiana Smith?"
"Other than my word."
"And no proof that Annabel Lacey either died or was murdered?"
"Does a confession count as proof?"
demanded Mr. Lacey hotly.
"Georgie told me herself just last month."
The coroner waited until the noise in the courtroom had subsided before pushing his spectacles up on his nose and saying very carefully,
"Told you yourself, you say?"
Mr. Lacey looked him in the eye with a lordly sneer. It was both a little too direct and a little too lordly, thought Janie. No one looked at you like that unless they were lying.
"That's what I said."
"And by last month, you mean January of this year?"
Janie watched as Mr. Lacey's mouth opened and shut.
By your own